Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
Welcome to another episode of Lost in the Static. It's just me this week, but Scott will not be joining us. His work schedule is absolutely asinine. We actually could not find a time this week to get together to record, so Scott has not left the show. He will be back next week. So I offered a bum $5 to come in and do the show with me, and that would be Charlie McMullen.
And the soup is free too, ain't it?
A man with rubber pockets will always steal soup.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? Happy to be here.
And hey, this is the very first one of the shows you've ever done with me, or even Alex for that matter, not counting Live Nude Geeks, which is live, where you don't have to watch your language, Charlie.
Very true, but slightly inaccurate. I did an episode of What the Fuck. I remember
that's right.
bath
that's
salts right. And a carnivorous fish found in Canada.
Yes, that was the bath salt zombie face eating. You are correct.
That was a good time.
You are correct. So what I wanted to talk to you about was comedy. Not just comedy in general, specifically stand-up comedy, although we can talk comedy more in an esoteric sense later. But you being a stand-up comic, I figured would be the perfect person to have a discussion about what I feel in both the past and currently is wrong with stand-up comedy and what is right. Would you call yourself somewhat of an expert since you're in the field and you're kind of a, would it be fair to say, struggling comic?
Well, it would be completely fair to call me a struggling comic. I will give you that one. I don't know if I would consider myself an expert because comedy is a very subjective thing. Everybody's sense of humor is different. They're like beautiful snowflakes. But I am definitely knowledgeable. I know how it works. I know what goes through the mind of a stand-up comedian, and it's not fucking pretty.
Well, see, what I meant by you know, asking you about things, and you said it's all subjective, and I'm going to disagree with you on that on some points. I really cannot understand the psyche of someone that finds Larry the Cable Guy funny. That, to me, is not humor.
It's not, and I could not agree with you more. Larry the Cable Guy is like Tyler Perry for white people.
Are you lighting a cigarette or a joint?
I'm lighting a cigarette, thank you very much.
I can hear you flicking your beck.
It's a Tuesday, for fuck's sake. I'm not a total deviant.
No, but by the way, I should probably point to this show. We don't edit, so that's staying in.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
But I mean, like, you know, Larry the Cable Guy. I know a lot of people find him funny, and he's a multimillionaire due to this, apparently. But how? He doesn't tell jokes. He just makes statements and goes, get her done.
Right. I think, well, I mean, humor is definitely subjective, but there are fundamentals. And from the point of view of a comedian, it really depends on what you're trying to do. Are you trying to be funny and share that with an audience, or are you just trying to be a dancing monkey for the audience? And Larry the Cable Guy used to be Dan the Comedian. And there's very little televised stuff before he became Larry the Cable Guy. But I understand he was really funny, but he was not reaching the superstardom mega millionaire status that he hoped to be. So he just completely threw all integrity out the window and became literally a parody of himself.
Now, okay, as a struggling stand-up comic, does that kind of burn your ass a little bit that he can be that bad? And he is more instantly recognizable than, and I don't mean this as an insult, than you'll probably ever be?
It sticks in my fucking craw like you would not believe. It's what good filmmakers feel when somebody mentions Michael Bay. It's just like everything bad about a sellout, including the undeserved wealth, is present in Larry the Cable Guy. There is just no thought put into it at all. He wanted the easiest route. And apparently the easiest route is becoming a fictional character.
And I'd argue the same thing with Andrew Dice Clay. And you want to talk about how comedy evolved. I loved Andrew Dice Clay back in like 89, 90, you know, when he first hit big. Or was that even before that? Was that even like 88?
It was as early as 84. I think 84 was the first year Andrew Dice Clay did comic relief.
Okay, because I remember him on the Rodney Dangerfield Young Comics special. That's where he started doing some of the nursery rhymes and the "Oh!"
right
stuff. And then I remember the Dice Man Cometh HBO special, which at the time was the highest ratings HBO had ever gotten in the history of the channel.
Oh, yeah, it was huge.
And I remember thinking that shit was funny when I was 15. Now, I cringe at those jokes. Is it that the jokes haven't aged well, or I've arguably matured, and I know my wife and quite a few other people will say, yeah, right, on that one.
Including me. I'm not going to buy that for a second. But no, I think at that time, because it just has to do with like where you are in your life when you first see something and how it hits you and whether or not it hits you in the right way. Andrew Dice Clay, from an intellectual standpoint, is no better than Larry the Cable Guy. He made a complete like caricature of himself, and that's how he's selling tickets and stuff, or that's how he sold tickets back then. I'm sure he's probably waiting for soup now. But I don't know. Andrew Dice Clay, I will give him this. Above Larry the Cable Guy, he aimed higher. Like, he didn't say, well, America's full of rednecks, I'll be a redneck. Done. Cash a check. He actually aimed a little higher. He wasn't really any specific type of person. He was more like a representation of a particular mentality.
Of every kind of New York City douchebag, kind of.
Exactly. And he was able to recognize that before there was a Jersey Shore on TV. So you got to give him that.
But see, the thing I'll give Andrew Dice Clay is he tried to not get stuck in his brand. Adventures of Ford Fairlane, yes, there are certain dice moments in that. He's not playing dice. He's playing the character in the movie.
Right.
In Brain Smasher, A Love Story, he's not dice at all. In Making the Grade with Judd Nelson, he's kind of Dice Man, but he's not really the dice character. He'd really tried to expand. Larry the Cable Guy plays Larry the Cable Guy on his reality show. He plays Larry the Cable Guy in commercials. He plays Larry the Cable Guy in the Larry the Cable Guy movies. He's like, I'm comfortable here. I'm making millions. Why should I want to expand? That burns my ass, and I'm not even a stand-up comic.
You mentioned the movie. I think that's worth revisiting just for a second. That it was Larry the Cable Guy, Health Inspector. The title itself is very flawed. If you are Larry the Cable Guy, you cannot also be a health inspector.
Wasn't he an FBI agent in one of those too, as Larry the Cable Guy?
Yes, I think so. It's like Larry the Cable Guy, FBI agent.
No, I think it was Witless Protection, I think was the title. I caught about a half hour of it on HBO one night and went, yeah, I ain't finishing this movie.
Nope. Same thing with Delta Farce. He might have a different name in that movie, but he does the same thing over and over again. He's a ridiculous hack, and there's a lot of comics out there that are like that. They'll just go with one note, and that'll be the thing. George Lopez comes to mind. If
Carlos
George Lopez,
Mencia.
Yeah, well, Carlos Mencia is a whole just horrible demon of comedy for entire other reasons. Did you ever see a documentary called I Am Comic?
I know. I'm going to go look it up now, though.
Every stand-up comedian working today has seen this multiple times. The years leading up to this movie's release, Carlos Mencia was taking shit from everybody, accusing him of stealing jokes. Like, he'll see one guy at the improv, write down a joke he likes, and then next time he's in New York, he'll go to the Comedy Cellar and do the joke there. Which is a huge, hefty fucking faux pas among stand-up comedians. Joke thievery is one of the worst things you can do. Like, you can tell a racist joke, you can have a whole 10-minute set about abortion if you want to, but don't steal jokes.
So don't be Dane Cook?
Exactly. Don't be Dane Cook. For other reasons, mind you.
And see, I lost a lot of respect for Jay Mohr. I've never seen a Jay Mohr stand-up, but I've always liked him as an actor. I think he's got great comedic timing. And he was on his podcast a couple of months ago defending his friend Dane Cook and saying, like, he doesn't see the joke stealing and all that. He sees Dane as one of the most original people out there, and other people, he actually said Louis C.K. steals jokes from Dane and then accuses Dane of stealing them from him. And my fucking head nearly caved in.
And rightfully so. The whole thing was ridiculous. For Jay Mohr's podcast, there's actually been more than one example of him defending Dane Cook when he really has no place to. Another one would be something that touring comics will do. If you go to the bigger clubs in L.A. and New York, They'll have their lineup, but if like a big name comic calls ahead, say, I'm going to be coming by in an hour, can I do a set? The club will, depending on how big the name is, they'll give them as much time as they need, and if they decide they want to bump someone who was already there, then so be it. And
that
Dane
sounds kind of douchey, though, doesn't it?
It's incredibly douchey.
And I don't mean douchey of the comedy club, because you expect that. They want the money. I get that. I mean of, let's just throw out a name, let's just say Bernie Mac. Let's say Bernie Mac did that. Doesn't he remember when that was done to him and how douchey it felt? You'd think they'd kind of go, no, I know what you guys are going through. I'm going to come on secretly after you're done and just kind of raise the roof a little bit, but you guys get your moment. No, they go, man, I'm the fucking star.
Exactly, and it's completely unnecessary. If you go to a comedy club, even with like I would say B-plus list comedians, like who are recognizable, not household names, but they're recognizable. If you have a whole lineup of them, they're not doing more than 20 minutes each. Most of the time it's 15. So all Dane Cook would have had to have done was wait another 15 minutes, and then he wouldn't have had to bump somebody. That's what makes it an abuse of – we'll see. I can't say abuse of power with a straight face because it hurts, but abuse of power.
It's kind of sick to think that Dane Cook has that kind of power.
Yeah.
But then you had other big, big name comedians that made their entire careers out of trying to give other comedians a step up. And I think you know exactly what name I'm thinking of here, don't you?
Sam Kennison.
I'm thinking Rodney Dangerfield.
Rodney Dangerfield, too.
Rodney Dangerfield, he spent his whole career going, I found this guy. He's fucking awesome. You guys should not watch my shit. You should watch his. That's why HBO, for years, every year, they had the annual Rodney Dangerfield Young Comics special. And that was so altruistic and awesome of Rodney to do that.
It really was. I mean, a lot of people wouldn't have had careers if Rodney hadn't done that.
Right, and that to me is not having an ego at all. I mean, you've heard the story about Rodney when he was shooting Caddyshack, I'm sure, right?
Oh, yeah.
For the audience, let's fill them in. Basically, this was his first movie, and he was doing his jokes, and then he would just sputter out at the end, and he'd go over to Harold Ramis, and he's like, I'm dying over here, man, nobody's laughing. And Ramis had to explain to him, they can't laugh, Rodney. They'll ruin the take if they laugh. You're killing them back here, but they can't laugh audibly. You're doing fine.
Right, that's like the cardinal sin of the professional extra. You can't ruin a take.
But I mean, you see what I'm saying about how, yes, he was concerned about himself, but he was more concerned about being funny and not so much being the center of attention.
Right, exactly.
And that's, I've always respected Rodney for that. And then, you know, speaking of Andrew Dice Clay, you can't ignore the whole joke-stealing thing. Now, I don't know if this part is true or not, but he accused Andrew Dice Clay of stealing a bunch of his jokes and then Andrew doing them first, so then it seemed like when he threw a fit that it seemed like he was just being sour grapes. I don't know how true that is, but kind of look at early Dice. A lot of that does kind of strike you as Kinnison-esque, doesn't it?
Yeah, very much so, especially like the overtly sexual stuff. I think whenever a comedian is going to steal from another comedian, the only defense against that is having material that is exclusive to you, that no one else can really pull off the way you can. And guys will spend their whole lives looking for that kind of a comedic voice. Not everybody finds it. It's not an easy thing to do.
And I would say, and I'm not accusing him of theft at all, but he did kind of co-opt the style. Chris Rock is very much the prodigy of Richard Pryor. He didn't steal any of Richard Pryor's jokes, but you look at their deliveries and their styles, and you can't deny that Chris Rock is kind of trying to be Richard Pryor, or do you not see the same thing I am?
No, I definitely see the same thing that you see. I think, I mean, delivery and style, you can't really own a particular style or delivery when you think about it. I think the difference between Chris Rock and Richard Pryor would be Chris Rock, he takes a similar approach to his material. He has a very similar delivery, but he is one of the most message-oriented comics working today.
Well, that's only because Richard Pryor's dead.
Well, I mean, even when you look at Richard Pryor at his prime, there, excuse me, there was a there's a special Richard Pryor Live on the Sunset Strip.
I have that on Laserdisc, for fuck's sake.
Exactly. I had it on VHS when I was a kid. I watched it twice a day. That, I would say, represents Richard Pryor at his peak. I think that's the best show that a lot of people have ever done, like of all time, especially Richard Pryor. And he's not really message-oriented in the same way that Chris Rock is. Chris Rock, he is definitely trying to make a point. Richard Pryor took more of an approach of, here's my point, do you agree? Chris Rock is definitely more aggressive about it, and I think that's what sets him apart.
Well, okay, speaking of Richard Pryor, we'll come back to that in a moment. But speaking of Richard Pryor, it reminds me, do you remember the very second episode of Saturday Night Live?
His monologue?
Well, just the episode in general. He was so unpredictable, and I can't remember if he was a drug addict at that point or not, probably. But that was Saturday night. Well, technically, they were just called Saturday, NBC Saturday Night. But that episode didn't go out live. It went out with a 7-second delay because they weren't sure if Richard was going to go and say fuck or break from the scripted monologues at all. That shows right, even back at that point in 75, how dangerous, in a good way, someone like Richard Pryor was.
Yeah, and there were not a lot of comics that were like that. I mean, you had Richard Pryor. George Carlin was dangerous, especially in the early days of network TV, just as live TV was making a comeback. You had Norm MacDonald, Chevy Chase in his prime. And believe me, that's a very short prime that I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Well, I mean, my wife and I saw one. This would have been mid-90s, maybe even like 96, 97. George Carlin was on Jay Leno's show. And my wife and I get the New York and L.A. broadcast. So anytime something's aired on a network, we can see it 3 hours later. And we saw George Carlin make a joke about his new book. And he said, I'm busier than a dyke in a hardware store. And of course, Jay gets all uncomfortable. And then the rebroadcast, it's I'm busier than in a hardware store.
Right.
And you're kind of like, really? You know, it almost sounded like George Carlin was trying to play nice. And he still said, not nice enough.
Yeah, I know. And that's the thing about TV. It's simultaneously the best thing that ever happened to comedy and the worst thing that ever happened to comedy.
But then, okay, how do you explain someone like George Carlin, for example? You look at his early stuff, and it was still funny, but it was all clean. And then something happened. It's like he took his first puff off a joint, and the counterculture set in, and the George Carlin that we know all of a sudden emerged. How often does a shift like that happen where it's the same guy and within 1 year it's like two totally different people?
Well, I mean, it happens. It happens to some of them most of the time for way different reasons. I mean, because George Carlin, I've read his autobiography, the one he was working on at the time when he died. It's called Last Words. If you've not read that, you definitely got to check it out.
I'll get that one from the library.
Yeah, it's probably in the library. But the reason why Carlin turned counterculture all of a sudden is because he'd been fucked around by cops. Because even though he's like the least Jewish you can get, he was suspected of being Jewish when he was on tour with it was him, his girlfriend, and his partner Jack, because they used to do a two-man act all the time.
Yep, I remember that era.
Right. During that time, he was arrested on just some trumped-up suspicion charge. He didn't have. Like, at that point, he not only done a completely clean set on stage, but he lived a completely clean life. And when he started getting accused of all this heinous shit because one racist thought he was Jewish, that's when he decided to just go completely counterculture and become what we now know as George Carlin. But if you take a guy like Bob Saget, he turned completely filthy, was forced, because he spent so much time on, like, America's Most Saccharine Show. And then hosting America's Most Saccharine Reality Show for so long, I can't say I respect it, but I don't say I blame him either.
Right, I can see that. But then you've also got the trailblazers. I mean, who are the people you say are the trailblazers of comedy? Everyone will go: George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Lenny Bruce. Now, here's my problem. I might lose a whole lot of credibility with both you and the audience here. Okay. I totally respect Lenny Bruce for everything he did and the boundaries he pushed. I just didn't find any of his stand-up to be really all that funny. I mean, funny in a funny level.
Yeah, and that's not actually an uncommon reaction to Lenny Bruce. because I love Lenny Bruce. I think he was really fucking funny, but not everybody does. But you can recognize what he did for not only for stand-up, but for free speech in general. And when you decide to be that, when you decide to have that kind of voice as a comedian, you have to make a choice. Sometimes message takes a backseat to punchlines.
Right, and I can see that. I wouldn't even call Lenny Bruce really a comic. I would call him a counterculture artist. Because a comic doesn't really fit, at least not the way I think of a comic like that.
I've always referred to Lenny Bruce as the Robert Crumb of comedians.
I can kind of see that. I really can. You know, and then one thing is I saw George Carlin live back in 1997. And yep. he was still, I mean, you could see in his last couple HBO specials, he was winding down. You could see he was not in the best of health and he was having trouble getting off some of those long rambles that he is so brilliant at. Mm-hmm. But we saw him while he was still peaking. And what was funny is he tried out a bunch of new material on our audience and he messed it up a couple of times. And he told us, this is new material, guys, give me a chance. And he would start over. I am so proud that I got to see like sort of that tryout process that I later heard on the CD that I bought.
Right.
I just loved that he tried that joke out on us in fucking Green Bay. I loved that.
He does that a lot because like I've seen him live three times. And whenever he was in a play, well, I mean, because I saw him once in Denver and then twice in Colorado Springs. And I imagine that kind of audience would be very similar to him as a Green Bay audience would, because he, I mean, there were points where he would like go off on a tangent. And then after talking for like a solid 5 minutes on one really weird topic, he would say, none of that is part of the special. I was just sort of venting. it's like a 5 minute setup to one punchline. It was awesome.
Well, okay, then I got to ask about two names that I know you're familiar with, but I don't know if you've ever seen or heard their live stuff. People that aren't stand-up comics, but absolutely do stand-up comedy sets, and that would be Henry Rollins and Jello Biafra.
I've never seen either of them live, and Jello Biafra, I've never seen him on tape, but I have seen Henry Rollins do stand-up on tape.
I've got all of Jello Biafra's. He just calls them spoken word albums, but he is so funny in them. They're basically stand up comedy. They just, you know, you want to talk a message. They're all stand up comedy from an uber liberal perspective.
Awesome. And
I saw Henry Rollins live in 01, 02, somewhere around there in Milwaukee. And he just basically gets up there and he just starts telling stories. But they're hilarious stories, and he clearly has punchlines. But he's outright said in interviews he doesn't consider himself a stand-up comic. But I saw no difference stylistically between when I saw Henry Rollins live and George Carlin live.
Yeah.
And the best part was, and this is something I absolutely want to ask you about, hecklers. What would cause you to go to a Henry Rollins show and then heckle him from the audience?
If I knew the answer to that, I would be famous by now. I mean, the reason why anybody heckles, there's a number of different reasons why it can happen. You can have someone in the audience who is drunk, and that's the only thing wrong with them. That doesn't usually happen. If you're drunk but you're not aggressive or anything, usually you just laugh, which is a good thing. Sometimes you laugh a little too long and it's distracting, but that's the best kind of distraction there is. Another reason is people who just have such an ego problem that they can't stand not being the center of attention, even when they bought a ticket, sat in a theater just to hear someone else talk. Sometimes that'll happen. And I don't know. I mean, there's no right way to deal with them and there's no wrong way to deal with them. I think it just depends on who you are as a comedian, because when I first started out, I used to just completely ignore hecklers. And
do you get heckled a lot?
Oh, yeah, I get heckled all the time. I think the key is you have to be quick. Because back when I used to ignore hecklers, I didn't let it interrupt the show, which was a good thing, but I did not really have the respect of the audience after it happened, which is a horrible thing.
It was one of those things like, you know, you suck the guy's dick in prison to not get shanked, but then you kind of have that reputation afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. Would you rather be, you know, a dead brave man or a live guy who sucks a dick every now and then? It's really, that's the choice you have to make.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, it's tough because if the audience doesn't respect you, then every single joke that you tell, if it's self-deprecating in any way, then the audience won't be on your side. They won't like you enough to laugh with you at that joke, if that makes sense.
Well, okay, in the case of Henry Rollins, when he was being heckled, he let it go for a while. I think he was trying to do what you said of kind of ignoring it. But it was, you know, because like I said, he was telling stories about him sniping people on eBay and him auditioning for a part in Armageddon for Michael Bay and things like that. And this guy just kept screaming from the audience, "Yeah, right, bullshit." I mean, and after about the fifth one of those, Henry goes, "Will you shut the fuck up? Just, I've got an hour to do my shit up here. If you've got a fucking problem with me, we'll deal with it in the parking lot later. But for now, shut the fuck up!" And the guy totally shut down, and he didn't heckle him again. Now, is that a good way to handle a heckler, or did he just feed into that guy what that guy wanted?
Well, there's a number of different ways to look at that, because I've seen literally that happen with a friend of mine. It was really weird. I was doing this show in Colorado Springs, really just a shitty old man bar on like a Sunday evening. Like it was just awful. Like it was a terrible venue because the audience didn't expect it. I think they were having comedians on after karaoke. And a karaoke audience and a stand-up comedy audience, not the same people.
Yeah, if you're not going in for a stand-up comedy, I can see how you're not ready for a stand-up comic. I can see that.
Definitely. And people in a bar where they don't usually have comedy, they're used to like seeing live music to where it's loud enough to where if they want to have a conversation, they just talk over it. If they do that during a stand-up show, it's fucking horrible. It is just awful because then the comedian gets loud, he's distracted, and there's just no good way to handle it. And it was a show just like that where my friend Kevin, he got about, I would say, 7 minutes into a set. They'd given him a whole 15. He got about 7 minutes in, and there was this one guy at the bar talking during the whole thing. Not even heckling, just talking to the dude he was sitting next to during the show. And at a certain point, Kevin, he just loses it. He just, like, stares right at him and goes, "Sir, shut the fuck up." And the audience was not really on his side after that because they weren't as distracted as he was by him. And that's something you gotta think about. Because if you get a heckler, if you say something back, is the audience still going to be on your side?
Well, I think in the Henry Rollins case, they were there to see him, not this guy try to call shit on him the whole time. But, I mean, in that specific situation of, like, the Henry Rollins, do you think he handled it right, or should have he just ignored this fucking jackass until the audience rose up and killed him?
I think he handled it right, but I don't know if I'm just saying that because he's also the lead singer of Black Flag.
He's Henry fucking Rollins.
I mean, I know, exactly. Awesome. I mean, I would not expect Henry Rollins to handle a heckler any other way. I would just question the size of the balls of the dude who actually heckled him. I mean, last time I saw balls that big, well, I don't want to get into that.
Well, I mean, we don't know if they were selling beer, so the guy might have been drunk. We're not sure. But you've got that, or you have the freakout moments such as Michael Richards.
Michael Richards.
That's absolutely how you do not handle a heckling situation.
Right. I would never do that. I don't think I know a comedian who would do that. But at the same time, I get what he was trying to do. I know that Michael Richards is not a racist dude, but I understand why he said that. It was just the wrong way to do it. His intentions were better than the actual performance of the act. You know what I mean?
Well, all right. Since you said you've been heckled, what's the worst heckling you've ever gotten? I mean, like, have you ever gotten one that really pissed you off? I mean, you said you've tried to ignore them, but do you have one that just kind of stuck with you? Like, what the fuck was wrong with this guy? Why wouldn't he shut the hell up?
I got to think about that. let me see. Cause I've had some pretty bad ones. I think the worst one is, because I know you haven't seen any of my act yet because I haven't posted any of it online. But my act is kind of – I don't want to say cerebral. It's just sort of abstract, the way that Stephen Wright was abstract, where there are no easy laughs. You got to think about every setup to get the punchline. And I was doing a show. I think I was 6 minutes into my set, and there was this woman sitting like at the bar who was maybe 3 feet away from me. After every joke, she leaned over to her friend and said, "I don't get that." Like, I don't get that.
So it's your fault she's stupid?
Well, I didn't. That's not what I said. That's what I was trying to communicate without actually saying that. But what I actually said was, after a while, I started going, "Ma'am, did you get that one? Did you get that one?" And then at a certain point, I said, "Man, there's this woman sitting at the bar. I don't know how long it normally takes roofies to work, but goddamn it!" I looked at my watch and I said, "Ma'am, did you get that one?"
See, that's fucking funny, though.
That we'll see, because I actually
did
had
she
time
laugh at that
I,
though?
No, she did not. She was fucking. She her friend laughed her ass off, but she did not like that at all. She thought that was. She was like, "That's offensive. That's sexist." And I'm like, "I'm sorry. I didn't think you were gonna get it."
Yeah, you see, what you just did there was. That was a cerebral shot at someone who didn't get a cerebral shot. So it sort of looped back onto itself in a weird way.
There are some comedians I know who welcome hecklers. They hope for hecklers because they are really good at that. They're really good at crowd work. Crowd work is something that you're either good at or you're not. I mean, some people are just not wired that way. But my friend, his name is John Christ. He's from Colorado. His set is totally clean. He's like a hardcore Christian, but he's hilarious, and his set is totally clean. And whenever he gets a heckler, he can build that into like a 5-minute bit. And I mean, that's a major skill to have. And I like to think that I come somewhere near there, but like the time when it happened to me, I had to plan that for like 10 minutes in my head before I actually started doing it. He would have done that shit right away. And I don't know, some comedians can make heckles work for them really well. There was this one special, even though he was like a B-minus actor, B-plus comedian to me, Jamie Kennedy. He started doing stand-up after like he'd done, I guess, what he dubbed enough movies. But there was this one special where he had a heckler, and he tried to draw it out and to make it funnier, and he semi-succeeded, but he semi-did not.
And see, I lost all respect for him as a stand-up comic. Did you ever see the EA opening ceremony a couple of years ago?
No, I did not.
Or the E3. He did this video game set at a video game convention. I mean, it was almost one of those things where you could just hear the between each joke. And you put the word joke in quotes. And he just kept going. And then he started berating the audience for not finding him funny. And that's sort of that. And we can't ignore this kind of – there is this kind of stand-up comic as well that it's kind of the Adult Swim humor. You know, that we're going to be so not funny that how not funny we are makes the not funny funny. Does that make
sense? It makes perfect
sense.
The line between that working and not working is just minuscule.
It's so razor thin.
Yeah. I mean, because there are some comedians who can really pull that off, like David Cross.
You brought up Stephen Wright. Stephen Wright's jokes aren't usually funny in and of themselves. They're funny in the fact of the fact that he said them like that is funny.
Right. I mean, his style of delivery was as such where his material at a certain point wasn't even an issue. He could say whatever he wanted to say so long as he said it like that.
I'd say Emo Phillips was the same way. I couldn't stand his delivery. But if you thought about his joke for 5 seconds afterwards, you kind of went, okay, that is kind of witty.
Yeah. And it's all the matter of when you come along, because like Emo Phillips could have had Stephen Wright's success. He was just a little bit ahead of its time, I think.
Well, now here's where I'm about to blow all my nerd cred with both you and the audience. And I know no one's going to side with me on this, but it's my honest feeling. What about when somebody is so funny on paper, when they're writing a script or they're writing a movie or something, and their stand-up just bombs with you? I'm looking at Joel Hodgson. I love Mystery Science Theater. I love the scripts he writes. I find his stand-up to be some of the most painful, cringe-inducing shit I've ever sat through.
I can't say I disagree with that. Because being funny and being able to do stand-up are... I mean, they're not mutually exclusive, you know what I mean?
Right.
Because there are some people whose material is great, but it completely gets lost in delivery because there's just not anywhere near as much effort put into delivery as there is in the material. I think Harlan Williams is a good example. Have you ever seen his stand-up?
I don't know if I've ever seen Harlan Williams' stand-up.
His stand-up should be awesome, but it wasn't. It was awful. He had great material. He just didn't have a way to deliver it.
Well, and that's the thing. And I've taken so much crap when I said this on a Radiodrome once that I don't find Joel's stand-up funny. And everyone's like, blasphemy! It's like, hey, I still like Mystery Science Theater. The guy just... I don't like that doe-eyed, I just came off a bender kind of delivery. Yeah, I mean, even when I saw Cinematic Titanic live, he was the one that I thought bombed at the stand-up part.
Right.
The guy doesn't know how to do stand-up to me.
Yeah, not everybody knows how to do it. I mean, you could be the funniest dude in the world and not be able to do stand-up. Michael O'Donohue is another example that comes to mind. Michael O'Donohue was probably one of the best comedy writers of our time. But he never did stand-up because he knew he couldn't.
Well, okay, that brings me to another question. Do you see a big difference between the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000 style comics? Do you see a progression or do you see a regression? Because the way I look at it, the guys in the 70s and in the really early 80s were really trying some dangerous shit that happened to work. By the 90s and in the early 2000s, I think that shit had become so old hat, they weren't doing anything except rehashing the same style of jokes. Everyone wanted to be George Carlin and Richard Pryor and Sam Kinison, and they just weren't.
Yeah, I think that's a very true point. I mean, I think the progression of time has a lot to do with that, because in the 70s, the only goal a comedian had was to get on Carson and then maybe get a TV show. In the 80s, every comedian in the world wanted a sitcom. And I think that bled in, like, that was the case up until the mid-90s. People thought, I mean, being a stand-up comedian was just a stepping stone to getting your own sitcom back then. And that made for a lot of really shitty sitcoms. Good God. Like, a lot of them. But I think now in 2000, being a comedian is an end in and of itself. I think, you know, I don't think it has to lead to movies, or it has to lead to a sitcom, or it has to lead to your own talk show. I think being a comedian has more honor now than it did back then.
Well, one of the things I saw in that progression was you saw Carlin and Pryor and Kinison and all these guys being dirty, but there were jokes embedded. By the late 90s, you saw people just saying fuck every other word and basically trying to one-up what Andrew Dice Clay did in the early 90s. And there weren't many jokes built around just how filthy can I be for 10 minutes. That, right. I think that to me was where I saw comedy start to die, when it was just, I want to be filthy, not I want to be funny. Because there was one guy, Scott from this show, saw that his whole set, all he did was wherever he went out and just insulted the audience. Yeah, y'all a bunch of pig fuckers around this joint. That was the joke.
Yeah.
And you just kind of go, why are you even bothering doing this then? You're not even trying.
That's an excellent point. I've seen a lot of comedians like that, like both wherever I'm doing shows. And there's some that have actually made a career for themselves out of that. And I think it has to be more than that. Because if you take someone like Sarah Silverman, she definitely says shit for shock value.
But she's also funny.
Right. It has to be more than that. You have to, because I think what works for Sarah Silverman is she says this horrible shit in a really sweet way. It makes her whole premise an exaggeration of the punchline. And I think that really works for her. But you have to have more than that. And like one person who I'm not a huge fan of, although I'm starting to come around, is Jim Norton. Have you ever seen him?
I think Jim Norton is absolutely hilarious. I'm actually trying to get him for this show. I think Jim Norton is fucking hilarious.
I wasn't always a huge fan of Jim Norton, because the first time I saw him, and this is probably not the best impression anybody can make, but the first time I saw him was on Tough Crowd with Colin Quinn. It was a pseudo roundtable show hosted by Colin Quinn on Comedy Central in the early 2000s. And he had some regulars, and Jim Norton was one of them. On that show, it seemed like he was trying to be more shocking than he was trying to be funny, thinking that's enough of a joke. I just have to say that. It doesn't have to be funny just so long as it's shocking. Lately, he's had more to that. And I think he's taken that kind of fury and anger and turned it in on himself to make himself sort of like a modern-day Rodney Dangerfield in terms of like self-deprecation and stuff like that. Just a more darker version, I guess.
I agree with that. But then you've also got, and now this is kind of deviating from stand-up comedy a little bit, but you've got the people who are basically doing stand-up, people like Opie and Anthony. I can't stand that shit. Yet constantly, listeners to all my shows will send me stuff. Oh, man, that joke you said on Radiodrome or what the fuck. Opie and Anthony said something, you know, similar last week, you know, and then they'll send me that. And it's like they seem to be the prodigy of Howard Stern. Just shocking for shocking. And we forgot to actually write a joke.
Right. Howard Stern was notorious for that shit. And I don't know if it's just a radio thing. Like, I don't know if that's what you have to do on the radio. But, I mean, there's a definite parallel. I mean, in fact, I would even call them the poor man's Howard Stern. And the actual Howard Stern is kind of the poor man's Howard Stern.
At this point, except for he's one of the richest motherfuckers on the planet.
So is Larry the Cable Guy.
Unfortunately. But then you've also got... Now, this is something that's always bothered me. Scott and I brought it up once before. Is... You'll sometimes it's a joke absolutely gets lost by a really bad delivery decision. And I'm thinking back to like Dennis Leary's No Cure for Cancer special. He started having a good joke and he's going on, you know, one of his trademark rants. And then he ends it with taking five puffs off his cigarette going, nom, 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 nom. And I'm going, okay, that just killed any humor that the joke had. Why did you think that was a good idea to do that?
I thought it was a good idea because the bit that he did that was actually about smoking.
But I just think it kind of ruined it. Like Sam Kinison, he'd be making a bunch of humor. There are a bunch of great jokes and then just end with, ow, ow, ow! And I'm like, all right, you lost me. You lost me with the pointless screaming for no reason.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that definitely happened. And it's just something that you either buy or you don't. I mean, you're really limiting yourself to people that are already fans when you do stuff like that.
Right, and I just think that that's sometimes a bad decision, like Larry the Cable Guy, the Get Her Done, or Tim Allen with the oh, 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 and all that kind of shit. Or who's the guy with Here's Your Sign, or something like that?
Bill Engvall, goddammit.
Bill Engvall, or whatever. And
yeah.
You just kind of... I get they're trying to separate themselves by putting themselves in a specific genre or style. But to me, that genre or style alienates me from finding any humor in the actual jokes.
It does. Well, it's sort of like going the Larry the Cable Guy route and then just stopping halfway. Like you're not really a fictional character, but you're reduced to a catchphrase. And I mean, that loses a lot of the respect of the thinking audience. I think anytime you have like a catchphrase or some kind of gosh, aren't I endearing thing to your act, you lose a lot of respect.
Well, is there a lot of, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but it's the only analogy I can come up with, an honor among thieves kind of thing among stand-up comics. I'm not trying to call you guys thieves, but sort of that you don't talk shit about another comic, you know, like you in a club, say the guy on before you is just fucking just dying out there. You know, do you have kind of this good job, man? You know, you killed him, and then kind of roll your eyes after, or do you tell him, dude, you fucking suck?
I try to find a happy medium. There's a guy, especially after everything you just said. I'm not going to say his name, but there's a guy in Colorado Springs. He is really, really not funny, and I had done like I think. Three shows with him up to a certain point where after the show we're all sitting at the bar and he like says, so what'd you think? I told him, I said, I think you need a lot of work. I didn't tell him you fucking suck. I didn't tell him what the fuck were you thinking? But I mean, you don't want to tell a guy he's good when he's not, because then he won't get better.
I can see that. Yeah.
I think the best thing you can do is just find a civil way, a constructive way to tell someone they need work, and then they go and work at it, and then they do get better.
But I'm talking about like on the big name level, like the Dane Cook versus Louis C.K. thing. You know, there's clearly a rivalry there, or is that something you only have on the big level? You guys have rivalries on the club circuit, for lack of a better term.
There's definite rivalries on the club circuit, especially if I mean, because two comedians I know are both overweight. Not overweight.
Overweight?
Well,
really?
Well, there's a couple that are grossly overweight. But no, two guys I know are big overweight dudes, and they do self-deprecating fat jokes in their sets, and they both do really well. But it's only a matter of time before they develop a rivalry because they're going after the exact same audience. And
okay, so
and
like
that,
NYPD
that definitely
Blue
does
and,
happen.
Sort of like NYPD Blue and Law and Order. You can't watch, you know, you have to choose one.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you have two people that are out to achieve the same goal, to win over the audience. The similar ones will definitely develop rivalries. There haven't been a lot of dudes similar to me, but when they are, I'm like, well, I'm okay because I'm fat.
Well, okay, now what do you consider when you've got an up-and-comer that does get that sitcom or that movie or something, such as Dane Cook has a so-called acting career, and, you know, George Carlin made all these movies, Richard Pryor made all these movies. Do you think that's selling out? Like, when – do you remember the George Carlin Fox TV show?
Yes.
From the 90s, which I thought was brilliant. I thought it felt like Carlin. It felt like they were writing to Carlin, had his style of humor. And then you find out in the A&E biography on him, he hated it. He hated every second of it, and he kept asking them to please cancel the show to get out of his contract. Is that selling out, or did he just, you know, maybe he just didn't like being on the set with the people or something? Because I thought that show complimented him perfectly. Or Richard Pryor's NBC show. Remember, like, where he was the bartender at the Star Wars bar?
Yeah.
In the late
70s? Yeah, that was awesome.
And he hated it. He hated every second of that. Is that sort of getting what you want and then it's not what you thought it would be? Or are those just two strange examples?
Well, I think they are kind of strange examples, given that Carlin and Pryor, before they got TV shows, had already had a gross amount of success as just a stand-up. So I think in their case, it's not selling out. I think it might have been a bad career choice in at least in Richard Pryor's case, because, I mean, he had an act that did not translate to primetime for major networks, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and he only lasted six episodes.
Yeah, exactly.
Carlin lasted two seasons.
I think Carlin lasted two seasons because, he wasn't selling out. He definitely wasn't looking to cash in on anything. I think he was, like, dissatisfied with the state of sitcoms and wanted to make a good one. And I think that's the best reason to ever do something like that. The reason he quit, I don't think it's because the show wasn't bad, because he brought this up in his autobiography too. I think the big reason why he quit is because of how different working on a sitcom is from stand-up. Because he said that the crew would gather in the writer's room and spend so much time talking about what to order for lunch before they'll actually fucking write anything. And I don't think he respected that kind of an attitude. Like, it just cash a paycheck, 9-to-5 attitude. You can't have that with comedy in any form, be it stand-up or sitcom. I mean, comedy doesn't work that way. It doesn't follow the 9-to-5 schedule. And I think that was the heart of Carlin's discontent with the show.
Well, all right, then how about, again, going to George Carlin, when a comedian, someone who's known for being insane, funny, and nuts, tries to do something serious like George Carlin in The Prince of Tides as the gay next-door neighbor to Jeff Bridges?
Is that selling out?
No, but I mean, what do you think of that when a comedian wants to try and do a straight role like that?
I think if they're doing it just because they want to say, look at me, I have range, it's not going to work. If they do it because they think they can actually do it, sometimes it doesn't work, but sometimes it does. A good example would be Patton Oswalt in Young Adult.
Which I haven't seen yet.
It's not a good movie.
The trailer looked god-awful. That's the one with Charlize Theron, right?
It is.
Okay, yeah, and the trailer looked god-awful.
And it was not a good movie in any traditional sense. But Patton Oswalt, to me, I mean, I can't really say for certain without actually talking to him, but it looked to me like he did what he set out to do. He wanted to take the sensibilities that every comedian has to have in order to be funny and then apply it to something else. And when you think about it, every comedian is qualified to do drama. It's just a matter of whether or not they, you know, they can open up their minds enough to do it, because I mean, I don't know if you know this about comedians, but you'd be hard-pressed to find one who did not have some horrible, fucked-up childhood or something to traumatize them. Because, I mean, the best comedy is born as a defense mechanism against pain. Makes it functional.
I can see that. You know, but then you've got ones like Robin Williams. He's known for being absolutely wacky, and then he gets a fucking Oscar for Good Will Hunting.
Right.
And who the hell would have seen that, or what dreams may come?
Yeah,
How do you watch Moscow on the Hudson and then go, yeah, that guy's going to later win an Oscar for drama?
Well, I mean, you're kind of torn when you talk about it in terms like that, because when I watched Good Will Hunting, on one hand, I was like horribly disappointed in Robin Williams. I'm like, what the fuck are you doing? You know, this is not your thing. Anyone else could play this part. Why did you do this? But then I'm watching the movie, and he is fucking good in that movie, man.
Yeah, he deserved his Oscar.
Yeah, and it's weird. I mean, because when you look at it like that, you almost begrudgingly accept them as a dramatic actor because you're so in love with how they made you feel as a comedian.
All right, now I'm going to test your integrity right here. With okay. Everything that you've said in the last 50 minutes. Yes, I'm putting you on the hot seat. Now,
okay, I'm ready.
Some producer comes up to you and says, Charlie McMullen, I've got a sitcom for you. What's your answer?
Well, my answer is what is the story? Like, what is the plot of the sitcom? And if it's anything like, okay, well, you play a stand-up comedian named Charlie, I would say, fuck you. If it was like if it was like a My Name is Earl type show or something that is funny without being just a bastardized version of my stand-up act, I would consider that. But if it's something like Home Improvement or Sullivan and Son, just a number of things that are just bastardized, Everybody Hates Chris, that are just bastardized versions of my set to water it down and make it acceptable for everybody, I would say fuck no.
All right, what if Michael Bay offered you a part in a movie?
I would kick him so hard in the dick.
Even if it came with a hefty, hefty paycheck?
Yes.
Because
money is not as valuable as that.
Because, you know, like I said, when we saw Henry Rollins, okay, yes, he was in Bad Boys 2, but he almost was in Armageddon as well. He was auditioning for one of the shuttle pilots, the one that Affleck's crew is on that crashes and dies. He was auditioning for that shuttle pilot.
Which part was it? Like, who wound up playing that?
Some guy I've never heard of, but he auditioned for that, and Michael Bay didn't give it to him, but he remembered him, so when he needed the SWAT commander in Bad Boys 2, he went to Rollins.
Yeah, and so, I don't know. I mean, maybe Henry Rollins isn't as much of a movie purist as I am, but, I mean, if Michael Bay offered me a part in a movie, I would tell him to go fuck himself, because I could not live with myself if I was in a movie directed by that guy. I mean, he's that much of a villain to me.
Well, all right, we got 2.5 minutes left. What about comedies, straight up comedy movies that are not funny? How do you make it through an entire like Disorderlies with nobody going, this isn't funny? Would somebody rewrite a fucking joke into this goddamn script? How do you make an entire movie like that?
I think a comedy that is like the Disorderlies, that is universally agreed upon as being unfunny, I think greed is the only motivator for that. I mean, that's the only reason why someone would make a movie they know is not funny. I mean, the Fat Boys were at the height of their popularity when that came out. That was just a lot of cynical movie executives wanting to cash in, maybe feeling self-conscious about how much they were actually going to get and skimping on the script.
Or it could be something, and I am joking with this, but maybe Larry the Cable Guy Health Inspector is a treatise on everything that's wrong with comedy, and we're using this totally unfunny movie to show you guys just how unfunny it is, but we know you're going to buy it anyway, so that's the joke.
In a perfect world, that would be the tagline of that movie.
But, I mean, did I can you smell the bullshit that I was just spewing?
Yeah.
All right, we got a minute left. Tell us where we can find Charlie McMullen if anyone has the stupid idea to try and contact you.
If you are so foolhardy, you can find me on Facebook, Charlie McMullen. You can find me at geekjuicemedia.com.
And your name, Charlie, is spelled weird.
Yeah, it is. Charley. I remember by saying, "Do you see that, Harley?
You're an idiot."
I know.